Cantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Health Communism, A Surplus Manifesto by Beatrice Adler Bolton and Artie Vierkant, narrated by Sarah Wellborn. Illness, you point out, is the only possible form of life in capitalism. In fact, the psychiatrist, who is wage-dependent, is a sick person like each of us. The ruling classes merely give him the power to cure or to hospitalize. Cure, this is self-evident, can't be understood in our system to mean the elimination of illness. It serves exclusively as the maintenance of the ability to go to work where one stays sick. Sozia Alistitius Patienten Collective, SPK. Introduction. Health is capitalism's vulnerability. There is no capital without health. It is capital's host. And capitalism's greatest trick is convincing us that it exists independent of this parasitic grasp, that it is indifferent. Health has no fixed meaning. It is fluid. Under capitalism, health has been defined to embody many meanings at once, from the hyper-individualistic biological health any one person possesses, always a possession, not an ontology, to global society-level constructs which attempt to give language to chances for survival at the population level. Health is a vulgar phenomenon, a race and class stratified matrix of constantly intersecting regimes of artificial scarcity, a destination, something one must always orient one's life toward, healthy physically, socially, economically, and metaphysically. More than a thing, and so often difficult or impossible to describe, health becomes defined by the things it is not. Non-cancerous, disabled, as though the purest state of health is to simply not exist. Health under capitalism is an impossibility. Under capitalism, to attain health, you must work. You must be productive and normative, and only then are you entitled to the health you can buy. This fantasy of individual health under the political economic conditions of capitalism only ever exists as a state one cannot be, to which one must always strive. The Sozia Alistitius Patienten Collective, Socialist Patients Collective, or SPK, called this cultural imaginary of health a biological fascist fantasy, because it obscures the true and violent architecture of economic systems of extraction underneath the shadow of a capitalist realist depiction of the perfect worker. The biological fascist fantasy of health is not unique to capitalism, but instead one of the keystones of a vast network of institutions whose function is the concealment of the social conditions and social functions of illness. For this reason, SPK felt that no version of health could be re-assimilated toward an anti-capitalist, pro-illness framework. While we are indebted to SPK's work, we disagree. We propose our own lens by which health is reclaimed not just for workers, but also for those marked as surplus, for all people, health communism. Capital has been allowed to define the meanings, terms, and consequences of health for long enough. In this book, we propose a radical re-evaluation of our political economy that seeks to undo capitalism's definitions of health by laying bare the violent and eugenic assumptions at its foundations. We articulate how health is wielded by capital to cleave apart populations, separating the deserving from the undeserving, the redeemable from the irredeemable, those who would consider themselves workers from the vast, spoiled surplus classes. We assert that only through shattering these deeply sociologically ingrained binaries is the abolition of capitalism possible. The contours of capitalism have formed around health to the point that they have come to appear inextricable from each other. Health communism aims to sever these bonds. As we will discuss, to do so is not only to remove one of capital's principal tools, but also to separate capital from its host. Health communism also attempts to give shape to a broader political philosophy that can guide left movements demanding universal care structures, a dramatic expansion of social welfare supports, or socialized medicine. Centuries have elapsed in the fight for and against socialized medicine, and yet the arguments and tactics of either side have rarely changed. An invective against an American national health insurance reform in the 21st century sounds much like its predecessors from the late 19th century. In the same period, however, significant developments have transpired in the relationship between health and capital, and it is crucial that our movements can recognize and target them. It is important, however, to specify what we mean by socialized medicine and how it differs from the larger project presented here. There are many competing definitions of socialized medicine, but the term is generally understood to incorporate a number of common characteristics. First, from a liberatory standpoint, socialized medicine is principally understood as a more equitable distribution of medical care, or health care, in which this distribution ceases to be a matter of whether an individual's class, finances, race, ability, or gender preclude them from receiving needed care. Second, socialized medicine is understood to be a program taken up by the state and provided to those recognized within its borders as its citizens, though not always to those the state does not recognize as its own. Finally, socialized medicine is often thought of as a state welfare program that can capably be situated within an otherwise capitalist state. We take issue with these definitions, as they can serve to limit our imaginary for what is possible under health communism. Equitable distribution, or redistribution, is an important goal, but what is necessary is to move categorically further. We share the sentiments expressed by others in international health justice fights. Health communism means all care for all people. While this is often expressed through appeals of need, that everyone should receive the care they need, we advocate for a more expansive approach than this. As we will discuss, the determination of need has become inculcated within capitalist logics and what we will describe, in Waste, as a determination of an individual's debt eugenic burden relative to social provision of care, treatment, or support a state deigns to provide. Similarly, our project advocates for an essentially internationalist approach to health communism. We will not separate health from capital by fighting for minor reforms that perpetuate the segmentation and policing of state borders and boundaries. We call for a radical abundance of care that functionally casts off centuries of ideologies of austerity, subjection, and extraction. It is therefore important to recognize that even as we fight within the U.S. for policies like Medicare for All, the task at hand is much greater than one program could capture. It is the total reformation of the political economy of health, and in so doing, the total reformation of the political economy. This is why, we argue, while many states may have systems that are referred to as socialized medicine, like the United Kingdom's National Health Service, NHS, In reality, no such system of truly socialized medicine exists or can exist within the capitalist state. Perhaps this is why, among all the social democracies that have instituted some form of socialized medicine, none have achieved communism. Countries with broad socialized medicine and social welfare programs routinely still maintain their surplus populations with overt antagonism. Our trans comrades have fled the UK to continue their hormone therapy in the face of artificial barriers imposed by the NHS's gender identity clinic system. Our disabled comrades in Canada hold disdain for the social democratic politicians in the US who point to the Canadian Medicare system as a panacea that should be reproduced, rather than the engine of austerity and repression they experience it as. Despite having socialized medicine, these social democracies are still, at their heart, imperialist and capitalist states. As Vicente Navarro has written, the British National Health Service is not a socialist island within a capitalist state. Some readers may therefore be surprised to find little attention devoted in health communism to the question of health insurance. We understand health insurance companies for what they are. Principally, they are financial institutions, concerned as they are only with payments for services rendered and the endless bureaucratic deadening management of risk. An entire account could be devoted to the study of these financial institutions from a perspective of health communism, using an analysis of the political economy of health. But our movements do not have time to seriously consider retaining these institutions. There is no place for them in society. Some readers may additionally be surprised to find no mention of the coronavirus pandemic in health communism, even as it was written in its throes. This omission is intentional. For all of the horrors of the pandemic, we are aware of no actions taken during it by states or private industry that are not explained in full by the pre-existing health capitalist framework articulated in this book. While it may be tempting to say that we have learned from the pandemic, it is clear that none of its lessons were previously unknown, and we are unconvinced that any such learning has taken place. Just ask anyone who lived through the dawn of the ongoing AIDS crisis. It is also important to foreground why our conception of health communism directly concerns many things that are not typically regarded as components of health. While this will become evident in the first few chapters of the book, which sketch the delineation of populations as surplus and how health has come to be defined under and by capital, it is necessary as well to define our project as one that makes interventions into the lineage of scholarship on what are called the social determinants of health. The concept of the social determinants of health is most widely used in critical public health literature, focusing on the wide confluence of factors that do and can impact an individual's or a population's health. Activists have summarized the meaning of this term best. To understand health as socially determined is to understand that, among other factors, housing is healthcare. So too is clean air healthcare. These social infrastructural aspects of life, not just housing and clean air, but food, clean water, public sanitation, social supports, in-home aid, a planet not burned and destroyed by capital, all have an impact on an individual's health and life chances, just as all of the things we traditionally think of as healthcare do. Importantly, this does not mean that the social determinants of health take primacy over what is more traditionally understood as care. Health communism, as a project and as a political goal, is definitionally focused on both. Health communism therefore proceeds through an attempt to disentangle the aforementioned factors that constitute the political economy of health in order to provide a framework for seeking greater demands and thinking more expansively of how broad our transformations of the political economy must be if we are to defeat capitalism. Central to this is our assertion that if we are to win health communism, our political projects must center the population's capital has marked as surplus, unwanted, discarded bodies viewed as waste that, nevertheless, have become the subject of capital accumulation. In the first chapter, Surplus, we defined what this surplus population is and how it is ultimately employed by the state and capital. The surplus populations, we argue, constitute a broad array of categorizations and are united in their degrees of being, for one reason or another, certified biologically, socially, and politically as surplus, and marked for what we call extractive abandonment, the process by which these populations are made profitable to capital. In Waste, the second chapter, we look at how, once certified as surplus, these populations are then used to stave off broad reforms that would otherwise be destabilizing to capitalism, usually through an argument that the surplus constitutes a burden to society in two ways, first as eugenic burden, then as debt burden. We then give a brief overview of how the movements for and against socialized medicine in the United States have been shaped by this rhetoric, and how failure to resist these calls has shaped the growth of the health industries. In Labor, the third chapter, we turn to how the certification of the surplus populations developed sociologically and in law and policy. We look to the English poor laws as the root of our contemporary distinction between workers, the productive and deserving members of the body politic, and the surplus, unproductive, undeserving, and how the policing of this distinction has developed as one of the central imbrications of health and capital. Madness, the fourth chapter, describes the asylum system as a paradigmatic example of the intersection of health, capital, and the carceral logics that must be understood in order to resist health capitalism. We look at how and why the asylum system began and trace the relationship between the institutionalization of the surplus populations and their value to society. First, as a problem to be managed through their separation from the productive working class, and later as a source of value in and of themselves, marked for extraction. In Pharmacology, the fifth chapter, we turn to the rise of the global pharmaceutical industry in the second half of the 20th century and its direct involvement in crafting imperialist international trade policies, constituting the ascendance of global health capitalism and marking capital as a severe global public health threat. In this context, we then look to the split over professionalization and industry collusion within the radical group ACT UP in the late 1980s and early 1990s, leading to the formation of the splinter group, Treatment Action Group, TAG, as an example of the difficulties coalitions must face in embracing the surplus and holding capitalism to account. In Border, the sixth chapter, we show how the rise of global financial capital and international trade agreements at the end of the 20th century precipitated the mass privatization of social welfare systems internationally, and in Latin America in particular. We argue that this expansion marks the moment when health industries and health capitalism had successfully matured in their host countries, the U.S. in particular, and demonstrate why internationalism must be an essential part of health communism if we are to achieve the end of capitalism. The seventh and eighth chapters, Care and Cure, form what is, to our knowledge, one of the most comprehensive accounts in the English language of Zootia elasticis patentin collective, a radical patients group arising in Germany in the 1970s, whose ideas have been highly influential on health communism, and who were the subject of a sustained campaign of public erasure that has left them largely forgotten. In CARE, we set up the conditions in which SPK arose, notably in the context of the anti-psychiatry movement and competing visions in the period of how medical and psychiatric practice should evolve. We then begin an account of SPK's radical political philosophy and the ideas that made them appear so dangerous to capital and the state. In CURE, we present a thorough account of how SPK were ultimately silenced and largely erased from history, marked as insane terrorists, to explicitly remove a threat to capital and prevent their influence on future patient groups. In HOST, the final chapter, we assert that capitalism will only be defeated through a movement that centers the surplus populations and resists the eugenic and debt ideologies perpetuated by capital to function. Health is so policed by capital because health is so necessary to each of capital's functions. This is why capital only fears health. It is our hope that health communism can be used by movements against capitalism and for liberation that can move us far beyond the scraps we have been fighting for in left health movements for over a century. The systems and capacities of health and capital that we describe in this account have, as will be made clear, only grown worse and more violent with time. There is nothing to wait for. There will be no better time. Surplus. Death comes all the more from without as it is coded from within. This is especially true of the system of cruelty, where death is inscribed in the primitive mechanism of surplus value, as well as in the movement of the finite blocks of debt. Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari. The production of death under capitalism is well understood. Innumerable terms and theoretical formulations exist to define the endpoint of capital's immiseration, the one constant to human life that our political economy is particularly adept at expediting. Social murder is the term used by Engels and his contemporaries. Its deed is murder just as surely as the deed of the single individual. Disguised, malicious murder, murder against which none can defend himself, which does not seem what it is, because no man sees the murderer, because the death of the victim seems a natural one, since the offense is more one of omission than of commission. Likewise, statistical genocide, or democide. Lauren Berlant called this slow death mass physical attenuation under global national regimes of capitalist structural subordination. The finality of death in the social imaginary as the ultimate conclusion of capital's violence can produce fantasies of a moral or ethical capitalism. This is arguably the dream chased by capital's true believers. With modifications to its systems, we can slow death to a crawl, render statistical genocide statistically insignificant. With premature death, the imagined enemy of capital's internal narrative of its own beneficence, minor reforms become enshrined as a legible mirage. But the primary sites of violence under capitalism are not those that lead directly to death. They are instead the quotidian forms that situate capitalist belonging, the reproduction of norms socially as well as legally and administratively, abetted by a cynical den of knowledge production, that institutionalizes logics of eugenics and austerity. For this reason, we focus not on how capitalism reproduces death, but on how and why capital keeps you alive. We consider what is elsewhere called administrative violence, in the words of Dean Spade, how law structures and reproduces vulnerability. We follow how those marked as vulnerable by administrative violence are not only immiserated, but also become the object of capital accumulation. Central to this is the figure of the surplus populations, the necessarily amorphous and indefinable category that is the focus of our project. How the political economy has evolved in the last century to maximize its exploitation of the surplus populations, pathologizing with one hand while generating capital with the other, is a process that must be understood by those mobilizing for health justice or health communism, and to begin to imagine a world free of the eugenic philosophy of capitalism. It is toward this understanding that health communism begins. The surplus population was initially defined in economic terms in separate writings by Engels and Marx in response to the moralizing demographic panics of industrial capitalism's early philosophers, among them Adam Smith and Thomas Malthus. Smith, the demand for men, like that for any other commodity, necessarily regulates the production of men. Malthus, a distinction will in this case occur between the number of hands which the stock of society could employ and the number with which its territory can maintain. Both Engels and Marx, in referring to the surplus populations as capital's general reserve army, make clear that their formulation has to do in large part with the population of unemployed people who could otherwise be a part of the labor force. Engels refers to the surplus populations as keeping body and soul together by begging, stealing, street sweeping. It is astonishing in what devices this surplus population takes refuge. Health, disability, and debility are largely absent from early discourses around the surplus populations that Marx and Engels responded to, except in cases of characteristic pathologizing of the poor. Malthus, again, the laboring poor seem always to live from hand to mouth. Their present wants employ their whole attention, and they seldom think of the future. Engels and Marx do, however, share concerns for the public health of the surplus population and the disablement wrought by industrial production. Engels's The Condition of the Working Class in England can be regarded as an early work of social epidemiology, locating capital's impact on the social determinants of health just as the idea of public health was at its formation. Marx notes of the relationship between health, private sector industrialization, and the state that health officers, the industrial inquiry commissioners, the factory inspectors, all repeat over and over again that it is both necessary for factory workers to have these 500 cubic feet of space per person and impossible to impose this rule on capital. They are, in reality, declaring that consumption and the other pulmonary diseases of the workers are conditions necessary to the existence of capital. A contemporary understanding of what it is to be surplus is necessarily more expansive. Major societal shifts in the late modern period, discussed at length in our chapter Labor, solidified the worker-surplus binary in public consciousness in part by incorporating a conception of workers' health or disability as a central facet in their certification as surplus. The surplus or surplus populations can therefore be defined as a collective of those who fall outside of the normative principles for which state policies are designed, as well as those who are excluded from the attendant entitlements of capital. It is a fluid and uncertifiable population who, in fact, should not be rigidly defined for reasons we discuss. Crucially, this definition also elides traditional left conceptions of the working class or the worker, as we will describe at length throughout health communism.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?